Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to The Waves for Thursday, September 6th, the grotesque display of irrelevant decency edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia, sitting in a DC studio with lots of construction noise. I apologize. It'll be over soon. And in the New York studios, we have June Thomas, senior managing producer of the Slate Podcast Network. Hello, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah. What's up?
Construction. Man, yeah. It's just like a drill in my head. That's what's up, besides the heat. Anyway, so listeners, we have something awesome for you, which is a show in Miami in November, on November 10th at the Miami Book Fair. I think that you all should road trip to Miami. All listeners who don't live in Miami, get your people together, girls and boys, and go and spend the weekend in Miami. What could be more fun, right?
Yeah,
right?
I'm pretty excited.
Yeah. I already have like a Miami-style outfit that I think about.
No, me too. I keep being like, well, I should probably start transitioning into fall stuff, but I should save this dress for Miami.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because Miami has like such a weird vibe. It's like you look in the windows and it's like bikinis and fur. Like, that's the thing you're going for.
Did you look in my closet?
I was going to say this.
You know what I was wearing?
You know, we don't have a video link, and yet that's exactly what I'm wearing today.
Oh, boy. Anyway, okay, on to serious matters. Our topics today, the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, extremely serious. Then the return of Aziz Ansari and Louis C.K., two comedians accused of sexual harassment. And finally, the term lady boss, what it says and obscures about this moment in feminism. And then in our Slate Plus segment, we will discuss whether it's sexist to call Hillary Clinton Lady Hillary, as a pastor at Aretha Franklin's funeral referred to her.
And if you want to hear that and other Slate Plus segments, you can join Slate Plus and support Slate's journalism. It's just $35 for the first year by going to slate.com/thewavesplus.
Okay, let's talk about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. The confirmation hearings of Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh are underway right now as we record our podcast. Day one was the most raucous hearing that many legal correspondents remember, with interruptions and protesters, some of them wearing Handmaid's Tale-style red robes and bonnets, getting arrested. We have with us Slate legal correspondent Mark Joseph Stern to discuss the hearings. Hello, Mark Joseph Stern.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. I have, like, a fundamental question about these hearings, a fundamental question which, like, I keep getting drawn into and I need your help with. So the hearings, it seemed like they were a little bit insane. Like, they barely got the gavel down and there were interruptions having to do with the documents. Maybe we'll just, before I ask my big question, did it seem that way to you? Like, did it seem unusual in its breaking of decorum?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Democrats intended it to be that way because, you know, just last year we had hearings for now Justice Neil Gorsuch. And in a sense, those were equally contentious because, of course, Gorsuch was filling the seat that Republicans had held open after Justice Scalia died under Barack Obama. And so Democrats were very, very angry, and their base was all fired up. And yet the hearings, though certainly tense, went more or less as planned. There were a few interruptions from time to time. Protesters in the back from Code Pink would stand up and scream. But that sort of got, you know, they got it out of their system, and the hearings went on as usual, and it was very boring after that. You know, the Gorsuch hearings are memorable, mostly for being boring and just dull. The Kavanaugh hearings have a very different dynamic, And I think that's partly because the justice that Kavanaugh is replacing, Justice Anthony Kennedy, is, of course, the swing justice on the court who has voted to uphold the right to abortion access, the right of same-sex couples to marry. And there's a very real chance that Kavanaugh could erode or overturn those rights. And so the dynamic in the room is just a lot more fraught. There are a bunch more protesters this time, not just from Code Pink. They were standing up and screaming and shouting from the very start, and they continued throughout the day. It was a very well-planned, well-coordinated. And also, Democrats have really clung to a certain aspect of the process that they have deemed illegitimate, which is the review of Kavanaugh's documents from his time in the White House. So Kavanaugh spent a number of years in the George W. Bush White House, some of them in the White House counsel's office, some of them as the staff secretary, and Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee have refused to request documents from Kavanaugh's years as the staff secretary, which he has described as the most informative to his time on the bench, and they have only turned over a tiny fraction of Kavanaugh's documents from his time in the White House counsel's office. And that is very unusual. Our previous nominees who have had political experience, like Justice Elena Kagan, the Senate Judiciary Committee demanded and received most of the relevant documents from their service, and that just hasn't happened with Kavanaugh. Republicans have kept most of it secret, and that has riled
up... Wait, they kept most of it secret?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, I guess my fundamental, like, the thing that I keep getting lost in listening to all this news, which you just did a fabulous job of telling us about, is that, you know, is it all noise? Like the people who are demanding these documents have already said they're not going to vote for him.
Right.
And the protests are coming kind of late. Like, it feels that despite this being unbelievably raucous and noisy and unusual for a confirmation hearing, everybody, at least in my little city, just kind of understands that he's going to be confirmed. So is it just a super noisy protest, but not an actual substantive protest? Like, I just don't understand if this is entirely theater or if I'm supposed to actually, like, think that something real happened yesterday.
Right. So that is the right question to ask. You know, we have only seen a fraction of these documents. Democrats are really upset about it. And, you know, they all began the hearing yesterday as Chairman Chuck Grassley tried to gavel in by lodging their objections and saying, we need to suspend these hearings. You know, they had just received 42,000 pages of documents the night before that were dumped on them. They said, we have to halt these hearings so we have time to review all of this information, all these documents. And they, you know, had this coordinated sort of one by one grievance process, and that was very exciting. It made for good TV, right? They were all saying, what are we trying to hide? They had all these great lines, but I think you're correct that as exciting and raucous as that was, it probably won't have any substantive effect. It seemed like it might have at first, because it felt as if all the Democrats might be sort of laying the groundwork for a walkout, which I think would have been productive. If the Democrats had all filed their objections and then stood up and walked out and said, this is illegitimate, I think that would have gone a long way toward, you know, at the very least, delaying these hearings, which is in itself a victory because the court has teed up a number of pretty big cases for its October docket that will require Kavanaugh as a conservative fifth vote to do things like roll back the environmental protection laws governing endangered species. And so, you know, Republicans want to get this guy on the court as fast as they can. It seemed like Democrats were ready to say, no, we aren't going to participate in this. But then, for some reason, I don't know why, Chuck Schumer decided, I guess, after all the Democrats complained, they sat in their seats and then went on as if this was just a normal process.
There's one basic question that I have, which is, we keep hearing or seeing in coverage this notion of the Ginsburg rule, which seems somehow to cause nominees not to have to answer questions about their opinions. And yet I also hear that actually when Justice Ginsburg went through her confirmation process, she did talk about those things. So can you clarify that for me? Because I find that very confusing.
Yes. So Justice Ginsburg, before she began the hearing, she said, you know, look, I'm not going to give you any forecasts, any hints about how I will rule in cases when I'm on the court. And what she meant by that was not, I'm not going to tell you anything about what I believe. What she seemed to mean was, if you say, how are you going to rule on these upcoming cases involving, at the time, you know, guns, the death penalty, federalism, and so on, she said, I'm not going to give you a hint as to how I would come down on that. She did not mean, I'm not going to tell you anything about my jurisprudence or what I believe, which is what most people mean when they say the Ginsburg rule. And you know that because, as you just said, when Ginsburg was, you know, questioned about Roe v. Wade and the constitutional right to abortion access, she said, yes, there is a constitutional right to abortion access, and under our Constitution and the 14th Amendment, a woman must have the ability to choose whether to continue or terminate her pregnancy. Ginsburg was not at all coy about laying down sort of fundamental principles of her jurisprudence like that. And there's, of course, video of this all, which proves that. And yet, nowadays, conservatives and Republicans who are sort of defending Kavanaugh's likely refusal to answer substantive questions are doing so by simply citing the Ginsburg rule. And that's just a bunch of crap.
So, Mark, what have we learned about him so far? To me, the most revealing thing to come out of the whole proceedings yesterday was a short video that I saw circulating on the internet where he turned around and gave an absolute villainous look at a protester who had had his child murdered in a school shooting. And he just gave this insane look at the protester. Now, maybe he didn't know all the context, but that was the sort of thing that activists are going to circulate and all that. But I'm wondering if there's anything actually concrete that we've learned about him so far that we didn't already know.
Yeah, so that's the moment you just described is probably the only moment that anyone will remember from these hearings, unless something really crazy happens over the next couple of days, because, you know, it was captured on camera. It was so dramatic. I suspect that Kavanaugh was not intentionally snubbing the father of a slain Parkland teen. I suspect, you know, this guy came up to him and extended his hand and said something about his daughter being murdered, and Kavanaugh, who is not a politician, does not have the politician's instinct to kind of flash generic empathy and just accept the outstretched hand. He is a judge, and he is not used to this kind of glad-handing, and so he just did what I think a lot of normal people would do, which is clam up and turn around, and I don't think that really matters that much at this point. The time to protest for Democrats, for the base, for progressives, the time to protest was over the summer, and they just didn't really show up. I think a lot of progressive women did. I think there was a stark gender divide here, but you didn't see the kind of mass outcry that you did when Republicans were trying to repeal Obamacare last summer. You just see the standard kind of complaints and petitions and rallies that don't really go a long way toward changing the minds of Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins.
Well, that brings me to something that I just keep thinking about. Why do we hold out such hope for those women over and over again? I mean, the whole thing, this has been this charade of like, oh, this is all about changing or like making sure Susan Collins like votes the right way. But she was always going to vote how she was going to vote. There's been reporting confirming that. So she talks about how she wants to, you know, keep Roe the standard. But that's not how she's voting with her party. Why? What is it about her that we still hold out this hope?
Well, you know, of course, it's not like there are any other Republicans who are going to flip, right? They are the only quote-unquote moderate centrist Republicans who ever stood any chance of voting against this nominee. They are the ones who voted to sink repeal of Obamacare, and that has sort of given them this stature in progressives' eyes, they think maybe they're gettable. Maybe we're going to convince them. You raise a very good question as to whether they were ever gettable, because there's now reporting that says Susan Collins, at least, has sort of pre-approved Kavanaugh right before Trump formally picked him. She said, yes, I will vote for Kavanaugh. I think that there is a small chance that if liberals and progressives had really shown up to this fight the way that they showed up to the ACA repeal fight, and made it clear that a vote for Kavanaugh is a vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, that there is no substantive distinction between voting for Kavanaugh and voting for, say, a federal ban on abortion, that you know, those are sort of the same acts. They are fundamentally anti-choice, anti-abortion. I think that Collins and Murkowski would have at least thought twice about it. Progressives did not make it clear that a vote for Kavanaugh is a vote against Roe, and so Kavanaugh is going to get on the court and he's going to overturn Roe.
All right. Well, on that depressing note, I'm not really sure. I'm honestly not sure whether to think about these hearings as like everyone's just given up and everyone's reverted to political theater, or to think, oh, well, there's something hopeful here, because fundamentally underneath all this is a kind of respect for the democratic process, for the judicial branch. There's just kind of a feeling that a protest can't overturn a Supreme Court confirmation hearing. And that's a sign of stability. I just can't tell.
I think it's the former. Sorry to depress you more. But, you know, if you look at one of the chief outrages yesterday on Tuesday, it was this internet conspiracy theory that a woman behind Kavanaugh named Zina Bash was flashing a white power symbol on camera. Zina Bash is part Latino, part Jewish. She is absolutely not a Nazi. And yet this spread like wildfire across lefty Twitter. And I think that's a sign that everyone knows this is going to happen. Everyone has kind of given up on the substantive aspect of it. And they're just searching for whatever political theater they can latch onto, even if it's conspiracy theories. I think the goose is cooked. This is not a healthy way to confirm judges. The court should not even have its current composition, right? Obama should have been able to fill that empty seat. And so the whole thing is, I think, a very, very an unhealthy sign for American democracy and our judiciary, because this is highly politicized, it's highly partisan, and it's sort of continuing the heist of the Supreme Court that began when Mitch McConnell prevented Barack Obama from filling that seat.
All right. A very, very last thing, and then we'll stop. Did you guys take did it hit you any way, his personal relationships with women in his life, the women that he'd mentored, coaching the girls' basketball team, the fact that the woman who's argued the most cases before the Supreme Court was one of the people who introduced him, and she's a liberal Democrat. Like, the fact, you know, we often look at how certain men treat the women close to them, like Trump and his employees. So did it make any difference to you that Brett Kavanaugh actually has a quite impressive history of mentoring and teaching the women around him?
No.
On a personal level, sure. He seems like a really lovely guy. And I'm very glad that he has enriched his community and the women in his life and made a concerted effort to have gender balance among his clerks. But that doesn't really matter when we're talking about a Supreme Court confirmation, right? My colleague Dahlia Lithwick has written extensively about this. There's this kind of grotesque display of irrelevant decency. We're all talking about what a great guy Kavanaugh is, how nice he is, how kind he is, and that just doesn't really matter when we're talking about confirmations to the Supreme Court. I mean, yes, on some small level, it's better to appoint nice people than assholes to the Supreme Court. I'll give you that. But, you know, when we're talking about people's fundamental rights on the line, it doesn't really matter to me if the guy who overturns Roe and subjects hundreds of thousands of women to arrest and imprisonment for terminating their pregnancies. It doesn't really matter to me if that guy is nice to women or mean to everyone. What he is doing in his professional capacity, how he is using his power, is fundamentally cruel and unjust. And so I think it's really necessary to draw this line between a nominee's personal life and professional views and say, we're not going to slander him. We're not going to pretend that he's, you know, a disgusting misogynist pig or that he's a really nasty guy. Kavanaugh seems to be a lovely man, but what he wants to do with the power that he will soon be given is atrocious and unacceptable. And I think it's perfectly fine to hold both of those views in your head at once.
So on that quintuply depressing note, because we're up to five layers of depressing now, we will sign off and go eat popcorn and watch television. Thank you, Mark Joseph Stern. Good luck covering the hearings and staying awake for the next 2 days. It's going to be hours and hours and hours. So
going to be miserable.
Drink some coffee.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Mark.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Okay. Louis C.K. and Aziz Ansari. Less than 9 months after being accused of sexual harassment, comedians Louis C.K. and Aziz Ansari both showed up in comedy clubs, the first unannounced, the second on an announced tour. Immediately, some fellow women comedians and commentators were horrified because too soon, and also what had these guys done to make good? June, let's start with the Louis C.K. event, because that one got more attention. How did it play out? What do we actually know about what went down in that comedy club? Because it's not videotaped.
No. So two Sundays ago, Louis C.K. showed up unannounced at the Comedy Cellar in New York. This, you know, is something that happens in comedy clubs. Other comedians who aren't on the bill, who people aren't expecting, do show up, do a set. Like, that's part of the vibe in a comedy club, I'm led to believe. And it was about 50 minutes. He did, from all accounts, kind of personal, you know, his typical like personal style of comedy. In one joke that was about clean as a whistle, whistles aren't clean, which I have to say in all of the coverage of this appearance, it made me realize extra hard how much descriptions of comedy are both not only desperately unfunny, but make it think like, how could that ever be funny? But anyway,
but the whistle that he was mentioning specifically
It was a joke. It started being about clean as a whistle, went into a description of the fact that whistles aren't clean, and then apparently morphed into a mention of rape whistles.
Oh my God, it's like the opposite of a joke. Like, yeah, when you, just like we get in a cloud, it was a whistle, but rape, and it wasn't clean. It's like, yeah, I bet they were just cracking up to that.
Exactly.
It's like impossible to explain a joke.
Exactly. But apart from that, like, that was the only one that people have mentioned. I mean, I don't know that we needed any more to be outraged. And it was so most of the coverage, which was gleaned by people interviewing folks who happened to be in the audience that night, said that, you know, it wasn't the fact that it wasn't so much the content. It was just him being there, being on the stage, you know, doing his thing. And for some women in the audience were not down with it. They were kind of giving him stone-faced looks, while other people in the crowd were super happy to see Louis C.K. doing an unannounced set.
Yeah, I keep coming back to this word that Amanda Hess used in a column where she wrote about it. And she said that he had slithered back, that he'd kind of snuck in. And I wonder how this would have played out in an alternate scenario where instead of sort of secretly coming by, doing one joke that sort of like, you know, touch the hot oven and then sort of jumping back, if he had done what he did on his show, which is sort of actually go at the grossness and explore his own grossness. If he'd done a big announced set where he like went in deep and did the not funny kind of like serious comedy version of it, where he was like, I am a fallen man, I am bad, and like done it that way. Do you guys think it would have been handled any differently? Would the outrage have been greater if he'd done the Louis C.K. version of it?
Yeah, it would have been like the Louis C.K. version of the Hannah Gadsby riff, but in reverse. Like,
really
funny,
in reverse.
But more of like monologue and not quite funny. I think there's no way that he could have come back that wouldn't have gotten some reaction of some kind. Like, for some people, like Roxanne Gay, it's always too soon. Well, we could break it down. Like, there are different problems people had with his return. One was the unexpected expectedness and the slithery sneakiness of
the
it.
The lack of consent for him appearing. So
yeah, like you didn't get to choose. Like if you were, you didn't get to choose if you were a woman in that audience and wanted to be listening to Louis C.K. and wanted to have bought a ticket and be having your drink and your relaxing evening, and then he comes out on stage and you have all kind of feelings about it. So there was something about the kind of abruptness and non-consensual nature of him in the audience, which bothered people. So I suppose it would have taken care of that problem. But there's a whole other set of problems. One is like, you know, there is, just as there's an informal process of shame and humiliation, there's also an informal process of penance. It's messy and ugly and inexact, and sort of many kind of communities have sort of tried it with different levels of success and failure. But he, you know, as far as we know, like none of these guys have attempted it at all.
Well, it's tricky. There's another aspect to that too. Like if we are talking about like, you know, rules or norms set by the community. If his community is comedians, probably a whole bunch of them would be ready for him to be back. I mean, like, it's not, I think how we define the community, you know, really sets the tone for when that right moment will be, if it ever comes.
Do you think that's a fair thing to do? That is, so the interesting thing that happened is that that argument emerged, that unlike in past times, because time has moved on, there are few fellow comedians, men, this divided cleanly, men and women, as far as I can tell, on Twitter and elsewhere, like the owner of the club, Michael Ian Black, Michael Che, sort of various people came out and said, you know, not he's my friend, not the dumb argument that people made, like, he's my friend, he's a good guy. It wasn't that. It was like, listen, I don't really know the guy, but let the marketplace decide. Like, if there's a market for him, then that's our standard. Like I don't like that argument.
No, I don't like it, but I suspect that's reality. I mean, it's not, you know, like when we talk about has he served his time? Well, no, he didn't do any time. There's no, you know, there's nothing to serve. It's not a like a legal question. It's a matter of, does he want to stand up there in front of people? Does he want to go on, like, does he want that, and do people want to see him?
Yeah, I mean, another point that Amanda Hess made in her essay is that you can't, like, it's actually not like he's part of a closed community where he really has to just make reparations with other comedians and with the women. He is a celebrity who takes up increasing amounts of our brain space, you know, and there was a time when you sort of couldn't open a magazine without seeing a Louis C.K. profile, and he becomes this unavoidable person. He was one of these secular saints, you know. Yeah. I think that's another reason why people are so disappointed in him, that they look to him in the same way people look to like Stephen Colbert or whatever. Mm-hmm. They look to him for almost what in previous eras, when there was more religiosity in America, what you would look for from a religious figure, right? So I think there's this disappointment that people felt that we had like given him part of our brain space, not just our brain space, but like our moral, we'd given over some of our moral, like thinking through the complexities of like the complicatedness of human sexuality. And then he disappointed us in this way. So that's part of the disappointment, and the like comeback discussions will be unavoidable. Like even if you don't want to buy the ticket, he's going to be in your Twitter feed. You're going to like see the magazine profile inevitably that's like Louis C.K.'s redemption or whatever. or like 10 years from now, Louis C.K., we found him hiding out in like Washington State or wherever it is. Like there will be like reminders of him as a person. It's like as when celebrities have this happen to them, it happens at a different scale. And right. So someone who just, you know, decided that Louis C.K. was their hero and then is disappointed. Yeah, they're not a victim of him on the same level as the woman who had their careers sort of like torpedoed by the position right. that he put him in. But they still have some skin in the game, weirdly.
Does that mean that that person who feels a certain way about him has to cede to popularity and celebrity? In other words, is it just a majority rule? Like, do we just have to say that the biggest celebrity and the most popular, that's what decides our social norms? That doesn't feel right to me. It feels like you can have
a welcome to America. Doesn't feel right.
No, but like there can be some other kind of moral authority besides like how many followers do you have and like how popular. That's an argument for the legitimacy of a lot of the stuff Donald Trump says. Like, it's not like the loudest person is the person who wins. Like, there are other sources of moral authority besides noise.
What are they, Hannah?
Moral authority.
I agree with you.
Like rightness, correctness. Like, it doesn't, I'm just saying, you don't have to completely cede to this idea that, like, hey, if people buy tickets, then cool. You know, it doesn't seem like the standard that we should all decide is the right post-Me Too standard.
Well, should know. But like, I just like what if there were like if it was a matter of there's been a legal finding against him or if there, you know, then sure, I could see that. But as it happens, you know, I could also see people saying, hey, he has apologized. He has done this. You don't have to go see him, but he has the right to, you know, go out on tour if he feels he can face that.
I'm not advocating for this, just right. to be clear. I don't think that I particularly want to hear from Louis C.K. in this way. But if I were the person advising him on his PR strategy, I would have told him to hide out for 2 more years. I think that's part of what people are annoyed by. It's like he couldn't even
too
wait.
Soon.
Yeah, he couldn't even wait a full calendar year. You know, I would have advised him to hide out for a while and then come back and like, you know, reckon is a word that we've been using over and over to talk about the Me Too moment and to like actually reckon. Like, I think that's something that would have been a more interesting way to deal with this.
Well, let's talk about Aziz Ansari, who, as you mentioned at the top, Hannah, is doing tours. Like, they're announced. He's not just sneaking up in people's, he's not just slipping into people's comedy cellars. But he apparently doesn't mention in his current act anything about what happened, which, just to remind people, there was a pseudonymous piece at babe.net that described a very bad date that is either a very bad date or sexual, I don't know if it rises to assault or like it's more in a gray area, I guess we'll say, and we can recommend that people go back to that episode where we discussed it at length when it first came out. But, you know, he did apologize at the time when the piece came out. What do we feel differently about Aziz Ansari?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different case study because I think there was a feeling in the culture, and we talked about it, that he had been so thoroughly humiliated by that article that there was just some punishment in the humiliation of and the sort of revenge factor of that article. And because what he did was different from what Louis C.K. did.
Absolutely.
I mean, he did not, you know, lock women in a room and masturbate. It's like on the line between kind of gray assault and crappy manners, you know. I'm like seduced by Noreen's theory that there is a space in the culture, if we are honest, for a genuine reckoning. And so there is something even odder about Aziz Ansari saying nothing. You know, like the blank space is actually not that productive. You know, I'm not a huge fan of silence forever. So I think I'm buying into the theory that you're silent for a sufficient amount of time. You're repentant for some amount of time. And then someone reckon with it, you know, someone. I'm not sure that how I would feel about just going to Aziz Ansari's show. There's an elephant in the room and he says nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I am very persuaded by this notion of, you know, appropriate justice. But again, I just have this question, okay, well, who meets it out? I mean, when we think about the kinds of communities that might, in which banishment would be, you know, absolutely a terrible sentence, you know, a very extreme sentence, like how would that work out in these scenarios? Like, there's no authority. It's not like there's it's not like the Friars Club gets together and at the roast decides, yeah, sorry, you've got 3 more months to serve or 3 more years to serve. Like, yeah, we are, there's no way of who's going to be the judge and jury, I guess is my question. And I guess it's the market. And it's not, and I don't say that with any enthusiasm. I just think that's how it is.
Yeah, I mean, you hear people bring up restorative justice in situations like this, but no, everyone's very short on sort of like
specifics
on how this would actually work, what they would actually want. And listen, we don't know. Maybe a version of that has happened in the comedy community. Maybe Louis C.K. did reach out to those women and like
I, you know, I resist this. It's really not true. It's just because we haven't done the research. There is just endless amounts of documents. I can send them to you about how to do restorative justice. It is a well-established practice, and it's not that new. And lots of people know how to do it well and guide it well. The criminal justice system is incorporating restorative justice, sort of putting victims and the perpetrators down in the same room and getting somewhere with it is now decades old. And so it's actually not that much of a problem. I guess the question is, who would do it?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what we're saying.
Well, if I were one of these guys, I would figure it the fuck out. Like, I would painfully do my research and figure out, like, how to be a decent human being in all of this and, like, and how to actually, you know, move somewhere. And it's interesting that the comedians come out first. Like, of all the men who've been banished, it's the comedians who are sort of slithering back first. And I think it's because of what one of you said, that there's just like a tradition in the comedy world of dealing with shame. And so, and just kind of like bringing it all out there. So they can, you know, they can do a better job of it. Like, to me, just like, you know, the marketplace wins is not good enough. Like, they can do a better job of coming back. I don't deny them the right to come back, but they can do it better. Well, if you, if anyone has views about Louis C.K., Aziz Ansari, especially if anyone saw the shows, please email us at thewaves@slate.com. We would love to hear what you think about whether it's time. Okay, our next topic, lady boss. The term lady boss or boss lady usually does not refer to an actual lady with managerial responsibilities like, say, Sheryl Sandberg or June Thomas or Noreen Malone. It's more often a marketing term tapping into third wave feminist vibe to encourage an attitude, as our own Christina Cotterucci explains in a fabulous dissection of the term in Slate, to encourage an attitude of self-possession and badassery. So as one beauty company writes, the lady boss is your confident alter ego, a no BS, take action, get it done, no compromise woman. She is the boss of herself. Oof, Noreen, can you just paint for us a picture of a boss lady? Like, what is a boss lady like? Like, what's her personality?
Well, a boss lady is someone who, what I'm interested in here is that it like gets at unapologetic femininity along with this sort of will to power of it all. Mm-hmm. Like, when I think of a boss lady or girl boss, I think girl boss is an important permutation that we should not forget here. That's sort of like the millennial boss lady who has a solid Instagram following to go along with her boardroom presence. I think of those. Do you guys ever read those, like, How I Get It Done kind of productivity style things?
All the time.
I know. Everyone reads them all the time. It's like the dirty secret of the internet is that those do weirdly good traffic because we're all obsessed with reading about how other people live. But I feel like a boss lady is one of those people who's like, get up at 5:30 and my Pilates instructor comes, you know, then I spend 10 minutes meditating and I like, you know, take like pear and kale out for their morning walk. Those are either her children or her dogs. I don't know. And, you know, then I answer email for an hour and then I turn off my phone for the rest of it. So she's highly productive, but then she makes time later for a manicure and, you know, she has one sort of elegant glass of wine later with her friends. So she's sort of like, it's the modern version of kind of the having it all trope. The boss lady is totally in command of her emotions and she's better than you at everything. And she's not apologizing for it. She's not feeling bad about being, you know, sort of leaving anyone in her wake. She's not, she doesn't need to read like management guides on like how to, you know, how to get a raise at work.
She might write one.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Is that, do you think that's a fair assessment of the boss lady?
Ugh, I hate women. I don't want to be a woman anymore.
Hannah.
It's just like a lot of torture. I don't understand why in every generation women have to invent a prototype to torture themselves. Like, it's either a prototype that's like too skinny or a prototype that like does everything. It's like there's always a sort of impossible ideal. Why? Why can't we have like dad bod? Why do we have to have boss lady?
Sometimes I describe my body as a dad bod. It's very freeing.
See, I'm going to defend the lady boss lady, girl boss. Because I think often, even though I actually have no friends like this and it's not really a type of person that I tend to get along with, I understand the impulse because very often the person who would describe herself that way is not exactly the person that you're talking about, Hannah, this amazingly high-achieving, the woman who does everything more beautifully than you. It's actually somebody who's really striving and is not happy with where they are and can't get onto a ladder that will allow them to move up, and so are kind of building their own ladder, and they, you know, they're kind of essentially repeating mantras to kind of to psych themselves up and just to kind of tell the world, maybe to paint a picture that's a little brighter than it might be in actuality.
You just wrote a treatment for a very dark movie, Jane.
Because I think, like,
that's American Beauty, but focusing.
Because I do think that, like, you know, it's actually a way of, you know, dealing with the fact that while women hold more than half of all the sort of professional level jobs in the U.S., only one third of low and middle level managers at S&P 500 are women, and only 6% of CEOs. And so you can kind of see the thing of, like, I want to be a boss. I don't know how I can get to do it in the normal structure. So I'm going to go out there. And it's often in a, you know, seen as like mid-level marketing or just like these kind of honestly kind of scam adjacent ways of trying to, you know, make it, because how else can you make it?
Yeah.
But is it sad, or are you saying, I can't, in your description, I can't tell if you're admiring or pitying. Like, is it a form of legit protest? Like, lean in my ass. Like, I'm not leaning into this patriarchal system. Like, I'm going to go and start, you know, create my own ladder. And so I'm going to have my own beauty company and my own, you know, Etsy, like whatever, you know, eBay based vintage store that's going to make me $1 million. Or are you saying it's a giving up? It's essentially
it's not,
I can't be boss of other people, so I'm just going to be boss of myself.
It's not giving up, but I think it is very, very difficult. And I think the odds are stacked against this actually succeeding. So there is an element of, like, I wouldn't say pity, because I admire the sort of the entrepreneurial spirit that makes that. Yeah, the hustle. But at the same
time, the hashtag lady hustle.
But I also think that it is an extremely, extremely difficult road to hoe. And, you know, although in certain professions there are ways that you can, you know, like in our profession, there actually is the freelance option. But in many worlds that isn't, like, actually, you know, the side hustle is a side hustle, not a hustle. And I know that there's, like, driving Uber and all of those things, but I do often think that it's, like, it's a little bit of a, like, story that people are telling themselves, that, no, I can make this happen. And it's incredibly difficult.
Right. Because the thing that you're selling, in part, when you're doing this kind of, like, lady boss hustle, is the image of yourself. It's, if you're a lady boss, you also have a side hustle in marketing, I guess. I've been thinking about this thing for a while that I've been calling LinkedIn bio feminism. You know, when you go to someone's Instagram page and they tell you about something cool they've done or something that was written about them, and it's like LinkedIn bio. It's this sort of, like, self-promotion of your professional success alongside your personal image, as a way of sort of, yeah, like you said, getting around these traditional structures. You're not, like, there's a 6% chance that you could ever be the boss of your company. But if you start your own thing and you promote it, like, you know, using, frankly, the attention that people pay to women, like, because of their appearance or just because they're interested in how they live their lives, kind of using that to your own purposes. That's, I think, what a lot of these people are doing.
Can I reframe this so I'm finding it less horrifying for a minute and see if it sticks with you guys? What about we say, I mean, the problem with it is that that using the term lady boss relinquishes the term boss and cedes it to men. So that's like the real, real feminist problem with all of this, is that we're essentially saying, you know, men are bosses and ladies are lady bosses. And so, but what it's about, that's what you're saying.
I know, it's so dark.
Yes, because the term lady boss, like, completely gives up the term boss.
What about woman boss?
No, just boss, bitches, boss. Not lady boss, but no, boss. But so what if we just say the economy is moving in this direction? So it's not just about ladies. It's like everybody has to do their own hustle. You know, it's like we are in that kind of economy where just in general, fewer people are making it up normal hierarchical structures. And a lot of people have to do their own LinkedIn hustle, private, you know, personal brand / LinkedIn hustle. And so lady boss is just like one of many tropes in the hustle economy. And then it's not so bad.
I think that's true. I mean, I think there is also something particular to sort of the rising generation that they are so interested in Lady Boss. And I wonder if it has something to do with being the children of boomers, right? Because there was this sort of like 80s power suit image of, you know, what would you call it? What's the name of that woman, that cultural stereotype? Like the sort of...
The bring home the bacon.
Yeah,
woman,
the pre-Murphy Brown, kind of like that. So the sort of boomer, like power woman.
Power suit.
Power suit woman, yeah. And millennials, many of whom really buy into this Lady Boss thing, are children of those boomers, right? So this is, I think you sort of saw it go away a little bit in the 90s. Like I was trying to think of who the archetypes would have been for this in the 90s. You had Hillary Clinton, who everybody sort of hated in the 90s for exactly that kind of thing, for taking charge. You had Ally McBeal, who was not a Lady Boss. She was like a neurotic, you know, associate. You didn't have that. And then the generational thing sweeps around and it's an update where it's got the sort of power woman DNA, but you've also got this layer of femininity on it. But it's the same sort of like capitalistic striving thing happening. I don't know. I've been thinking about that too.
Yeah. So it's just self-made woman. That's okay.
I want to pipe in to mention that on September 17th, Slate has a sort of limited run podcast starting. It's called Women in Charge. And Julia Turner, our Lady Boss and also our boss. is going to be interviewing other bosses who are women, with people like Aline Brosh McKenna, who is the showrunner of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and a very high-ranking military officer and a restaurateur and the president of a university. And I think it's going to deal with a lot of the sort of questions of what it's like to be a boss who is a woman.
Right. I mean, part of the reason the term Lady Boss came around is there are extra challenges inherent to being like a woman in charge. It just is something so belittling about lady.
Absolutely.
Do you guys think boss bitch is okay? Like that's,
Jesus with the terms. You're the boss or you're not the boss. It's like boss bitch is even worse.
Well, boss bitch is a slang term, Hannah. It's like if you're not a basic bitch, you're a bots bitch. You know, it's like a no.
But that's different. That describes your personality. Like a high school girl can be a boss bitch. It's not describing your actual like professional persona, right?
No.
Big sigh.
But a lady boss doesn't really separate her professional persona and her personal one.
That's true. All right. Well, if we got any Lady Boss listeners and you want to defend the Lady Boss from my cynical spitting, then please defend the Lady Boss and convince me that Lady Bosses are the future and I should respect all Lady Bosses and bow down to them. You can go on our Facebook page or write us at thewaves@slate.com. All right, let's move on to recommendations. Today is a very, very special day for recommendations because our fabulous, beautiful, wonderful producer, the Lady Boss Vera Lynn, is going off to WNYC. And so she's going to join us for recommendations on her last day as producer. Vera Lynn, why don't you go first?
Hello. Okay, so I want to recommend a Facebook show called Profile by BuzzFeed News. It's an interview talk show hosted by NPR's own Audie Carnage. And one, it was nice to see a radio host do television. You know, I'm like, what is the trajectory of a really talented radio host? And the one that I saw first was a conversation with Drew Dixon, who is the former A&R director of Russell Simmons' Def Jam Records. And she alleges that her boss at the time, Russell, raped her in the 90s. And, you know, in this whole Me Too movement, I have felt like women of color, black women in particular, were few and far between, not because it didn't happen, but just the feeling of like, what is it going to mean? Am I going to get the same type of rallying around and support? And it was very, I think the fact that Audie was interviewing her made the conversation go deeper in a way, because there was a moment where Audie, you know, asked her the inevitable question, like, why didn't you make an official complaint, go to the police? You know, there was a lawsuit happening at the time. Why didn't you speak to your lawyers about it? And she says, you know, 20 years before, I saw what happened to the Anita Hill in the Anita Hill hearings. And I saw what happened to Miss Black America, Desiree Washington, when she came forward about being raped by Mike Tyson. And just knowing that specifically that the Black community was like, who are these women trying to take down these amazing Black men that weren't so special? So, yeah, I recommend that series. But also, you know, I think this is my last day ringing the bell of what I always do, which is representation. Right. And so I feel like the conversation did go further because it was Audie interviewing Drew Dixon about what happened to her.
Can I just say also that Audie's the best?
She
I
is
love
the best.
Her. As my colleague, I love Audie. She is awesome in every way that a person can be awesome. I just want to say, Vera Lynn, thank you so much for being an awesome producer and for jumping in when you jump in. And just, I wish you the best. It has been amazing to have you around.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are going to miss you on this show.
In my goodbye email, I mentioned that I was listening to the Double X since Jess Gross was on. So,
woo,
shout out Jess.
So it's been such a pleasure and like very meta for me to be the producer of this show.
And we'll be hearing from you again. You're not disappearing forever.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just a little less, a slightly different relationship.
All right, Noreen, what do you got?
Well, this is going to be an entry in my ongoing I'm discovering older dead white men kind of reading series. I have never been a Philip Roth person. I read Portnoy's Complaint years ago and was sort of like, I guess I get it, but it's not for me kind of thing. And then I read, I recommended Asymmetry a few months back, really loved that book. And it had just such a sort of warm portrait of a Philip Roth character. And it made me sort of open to reading, trying him again. And then obviously I read a lot of the Encomiums around his death. So anyway, I decided to give Philip Roth another try. I read Goodbye Columbus, which is a sort of slim book of short stories. And I just loved it. I don't know, maybe it was because it was the end of summer and I was lying on a blanket in Fort Greene Park and reading these sort of gentle, funny, like deep stories. Or, you know, maybe Philip Roth is what people say he is. You know, I wasn't sort of as turned off by his treatment of women in Goodbye Columbus as I had been a little bit in Portnoy. So I guess my recommendation is both that volume and also sort of giving people a chance when you sort of know that you're going to dislike certain things about them, you know, not just sort of not deciding to read this person because you're annoyed by the way people talk about him or the stature that he's given in the culture. So Philip Roth, Goodbye Columbus. I'm the first to discover it.
I cannot believe this. I love how Noreen just like slips in. She's like, I'm just going to do a recommendation. Philip Roth, I'm going to piss off all the listeners and everybody and just start a controversy. Be like, you guys, just give him a second chance. Bye, Hannah. What do you got? We're going to have a Philip Roth segment.
I would love that, actually.
And hash this out.
Yeah, I'm going to keep reading and keep reporting back.
Yeah. Okay, well, mine is much more innocuous and not going to piss off anyone, which is the second season of Glow, which I finally got around to watching, which is so good. And they have pulled off something which I think, you know, I just admire as a maker of radio and other things. It's like they took this completely and disparate set of characters, which could have been sort of comical and indistinct, and managed to make almost each of them memorable in particular in a way that Orange is the New Black tried, but ended up doing in a completely formulaic way, like flashback, personal story, like it just became, you know, sort of same. And I thought Glow, like, did that masterfully, like, just weaving in a little of their histories into the sort of personal life dramas and kind of what their roles were in the show. There was a Me Too moment in season two, which I thought was handled just really, really unusually interestingly well. So anyway, I think it's better than the first season, and I'm really enjoying it.
I watched it when it first came out, so I've now forgotten a little bit. But I felt like, I agree with you. I liked it. But to me, they did lose kind of control of some of the characters. I'm afraid now it's been too long and I can't remember their names. But for example, the Black woman who has a son who's at Stanford, like there was a one amazing episode and then it's almost like we forgot about her. And then suddenly she's got these characters, you know, the action figures that they somehow cut that storyline. So I wish they had controlled that a little even better. Like maybe they lose some of the characters if they're going to go deep on all of them. And I would, just to defend Orange is the New Black, in the most, they've kind of let go of the flashbacks now. And I think it's kind of come around. The most recent season is pretty good. But now I will stop defending.
Yeah. Okay. June.
I'm going to recommend a show that is on Netflix. It has a terrible title, but it is so good. It's called Churchill's Secret Agents, The New Recruits.
That's a great title. I don't know what you're talking about. Big box office.
It's a British show. I actually saw an episode when I was visiting my mom earlier this year. And what they've done, so in World War II, the British forces recruited people to be special agents, SOE agents. And they would then go into Europe and do things that weren't really allowed by the military. So they were spies, basically. And in this show, they take, you know, contemporary people and they put them through the training that SOE agents would have done. And they also do bits of history, like actual films and stories of people who were SOE agents who went into Poland or went into Norway. And it sounds formulaic, but it is, especially as you kind of, the more episodes in you are, like, it gets really moving. I was really kind of moved by the people, like what people are putting themselves through physically in order to, you know, fight for right. They're a little bit vague on, you know, what it would be that people were fighting if they were in the SOE now. But they also, they get to dress up in like vintage clothing, which I think looks really good. As weird as it sounds, give it an episode. It's only 5 episodes total, and it's got the awful name Churchill's Secret Agents, The New Recruits.
I think it's a good title. All right, well, that's our show for today. Thank you for the very last time to our wonderful producer, Verilyn Williams. Thank you, Verilyn. To our production assistant, Alex Barish. Thank you, listeners, also. You've been getting in touch with us on Twitter, each individually, which we appreciate, emailing us at thewaves@slate.com. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen. The Waves will be back next week.